We'll begin Perek Hey, Pasuk Chof Gimel. We're in our third installment of Shiras Devaira, the Song of Devaira, which has lately turned into an analysis of the events of the war. Perek Hey, Pasuk Chof Gimel. And in the previous few psukim, we saw her sorting out. We saw that it was basically what we called the uncomfortable preview of how it works in Olam Haba. When the divine word comes and says, shows you how transparent your excuses are, right? We had the different shvat, and this one couldn't come because they were too far. These ones were scared. And how the Navi comes and says, that excuse, false. That excuse, false. That excuse was true. Right? And now we move on. Just one more pasuk to this effect. Ayru meiroiz omar malach Hashem. Up till now, Devaira was simply expressing her disapproval. But that was it. There were no consequences. She made fun of Reuven. She even, more than that, she expressed resentment. She said that she was disillusioned by what she saw with Reuven. With Dan, she made fun of them. She made fun of them all in their boats heading far away. But now, Oyru Meiroiz Omar Hashem, Omar Malach Hashem. Curse Meiroiz, says the angel of Hashem. Meiroiz was close by to the battle, capable of coming. There was no rationalization at all. Who was Meiroiz? We'll get to it in a minute. But whoever Meiroiz was, Meiroiz was different than everybody else. There was some form of rationalization, which, I'll be weak, didn't really make the grade, didn't warrant the curse. But Meiroiz was either a town, or a person, or, I don't know what this means, that's right, a malach. A malach, we saw last week that even the stars joined the battle somehow. This was either a person, town, or malach that kept away. And the malach, don't ask me to explain. If you have an explanation, I'll be happy to hear it. But the... Oh, you have one.
I heard some connection to Rav Zemir Cohen. Something to do with Mars, Meiroz, like a planet, like a play on the word, Meiroz.
But then do we understand why Mars is blamed for not joining? I don't know. That's interesting. Mars, Meiroz, I hear. But otherwise, it was either a very influential person who could have borne his influence on the war and helped out. Let's remember, this also reminds us of the dynamics here. Devaira did not have control over the Jewish people. And there were influential and powerful people around who either cooperated with her and lent their weight to her campaign of trying to influence the Jewish people. And then there were those who distinctly did not. Either it was below their dignity to like follow the leadership of a woman or whatever it is, but there were people, important individuals. We've had such phenomena in history where there were important, distinguished people who couldn't overcome certain character traits and do the right thing. So this may rise, according to the understanding that this was actually a person, that's the pshat. It's not like she picked on one person, why didn't you come? No, we're talking about a person who was very influential. Whether the pshat is that he was a Torah leader or that he was just a community leader, I don't know. It's very vague, it's very ambiguous. But whatever the case is, yes, we are seeing that in Klal Yisrael, it's not like, let's not think that Devaira was like the clear leader and everybody was following her and she just let everybody out to battle. No, it wasn't like that at all. And that, on the contrary, highlights the uniqueness of the event. We see that there were the select few, or maybe it wasn't so few, but whatever it was, it certainly was not everybody. And there were very so-called important parties that weren't a part of this whole Devaira clan, this whole Devaira cult. Like, they weren't a part of this whole thing. It was just kind of funny. A woman has a following, you know. It was funny. And they weren't a part of it. All of a sudden, After this war, it turns out, yes, these people had proved their faithfulness at the end of the day. Again, the word of Nebuah is coming and saying that at the end of the day, those who were sincere and those who were really looking for the truth, and those who were not blinded by their egos or whatever other considerations there were, they were there with Devaira. So it at the time might have appeared as a small, ragtag, funny bunch, actually turned out to be the heroes of Klal Yisrael and recognized as the ones, the mainstream, right? So Eiru Meiroi Zoymar Malach Hashem. Curse Meiroi, says the Malach of Hashem. What Malach said this? So this is either Devaira issuing this curse based on prophecy that she received. That's what she means by saying she got word by the Malach that Meiroi is to be cursed. Or it's actually referring to Barak, who issued this curse based on his own prophecy. Oiru Oro Yishvel. All of their inhabitants should be cursed. Meaning again, this either refers to a town called Meiroi's, or it was an individual with the people around him. Meaning there was this whole circle, right? There were the Meiroi's people, whose Shita was, they didn't hold of Devaira. Right? They didn't hold of her. And they weren't a part of that, you know, and therefore they didn't come. And now Hashem is giving his psak on them. Ki lo ba'u le'ezras Hashem. They did not come to the aid of Hashem. Le'ezras Hashem ba'giborim. They did not come to aid Hashem against the mighty Sisra. You hear the way she's putting it? Not that they didn't come to the aid of their brethren. They didn't come to the aid of Hashem. Meaning Hashem is saying yes. When it's an issue of fighting for the Jewish people, it's an issue of fighting for me. If you're there helping fight for the Jewish people, you're fighting for me. It's an issue of coming to my aid. These people did not just sit around and desert Devaira and desert Devaira and her following. These people deserted me. And now we move on to the next part of the analysis. And this, here we're getting into very heavy duty territory. Who's the other character in this story? Yael. Devaira has basically been analyzing, one by one, giving the prophetic analysis of each of the different people. And now we have Yael, and we know what she did. Right? When Sisera was fleeing, she, in order to weaken him and kill him, as we discussed the other time, and we'll be discussing it again now, she seduced him. Talking about a married woman who seduced him in order to lure him into her tent and to keep him there. Meaning otherwise, we don't know. He might have hopped a cat nap and been on his way. We don't know how much time it took for Barak to catch up with him. But this guy was a capable guy. He probably would have been out of there very quickly. She seduced him, but to such an extent that he was with her 7 times, which again, can't mean 7 times one after the other. It doesn't work, right? Point was, she was trying to schlep things out on the simple understanding. She seduced him and then got him going again and again and again. Presumably, right, this isn't spelled out, but presumably the idea was that she actually kept him around for at least a good few hours. And Lemaisa, at the end of the day, where does she stand after all this? Did she do the right thing? And as we'll see soon, not only the rest of everybody else wants to know this, but she herself doesn't know where she stands. This is part of what's so amazing about what she did. Yael. She herself needed to be vindicated by the word of the Devaira to come and say, Yael wasn't sure. Where is she now? In Gan Eden or in Gehenim? She knew that it's not Parv anymore. She's finished her career. She's either made it to the highest place in Gan Eden, or she's in the deepest place in Gehenim. She doesn't know that. So let's see. Tivayrach minashim Yael, Eishes Chever Akeni. May Yael, the wife of Chever Akeni, be blessed by women. Minashim ba'oyel tivayrach. May she be blessed by women in the tent. What's she saying here? So what she's saying is as follows. First she starts by saying that she be blessed by women, meaning women should look up to her. Naturally, the way it works among women is that when you hear that a woman did what she did, she's going to be an outcast, right? So first of all, she says no. She should be blessed by women, and she will be blessed by women. But then the Vayera goes a giant step further and says she will be blessed from the women in the tents. Who are the women in the tents? We have some famous women who lived in tents, the three matriarchs, the three mothers of Klal Yisrael. Four mothers, sorry. The four mothers, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. The Vayera now is coming and saying she's up on their in their category, equal footing with them. So now, let's understand what's going on here. Why is she being compared to them? In a general way, what the Vayera is saying is she should be blessed from women in the tents, meaning most women stay in their tents, mitznias. She went out of her tents to actually draw Sisra in. Most women stay in their tents, mitznias, and dedicate their lives to their husbands, which is the sublime function of a woman. She dedicates her intimate life to her husband, right? And women are blessed for doing that. And now the Vayera is saying the truth is that this is a very, very great thing. A woman's intimacy with her husband is levels of kedusha. It's from the highest things that there are in Judaism. And the Vayera is coming and saying not only did Yael do the right thing, but what she did is of an equal level of kedusha to when women are with their husbands. Her being with Sisra is of an equal level of kedusha to what women being with their husbands. So I just want to read a little piece of Gemara which really forms the basis for the discussion here. So the Gemara says as follows. And this is a famous concept of what we call Aveira Lishma. An Aveira done for the right purpose. Omer Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchok. G'dayla Aveira Lishma mi mitzvah shaloi lishma. An Aveira done for the right reason, for pure motives, is greater than a mitzvah done stam. So the Gemara asks, okay, the Gemara questions that and ends up saying, you know what? Kemitzvah shaloi lishma. It's the same as a mitzvah. So it's greater than a mitzvah. It's the same as a mitzvah. And aveira done for the right reason is the same as a mitzvah. Now, if we just stop here, that's great. Anytime you can rationalize an aveira, I know that I'm not going to Gan Eden. Right? You do an aveira for the right purposes, and you're okay. So now the Gemara continues. Diksiv, as it says in the Pasuk, Tevoirach minoshim Yael eshes chever hakeni. May Yael, the wife of chever hakeni, be blessed from or by women in the tents. Minoshim ba'el tevoirach. She should be blessed by women in the tents. Now, man noshim shebo'el, which women in tents are we talking about? Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Velea. And we are putting her up on the same footing as them. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, as we said before, Sheva bi'ilois ba'al oisei rosha ba'oisei shah. At that time, this Rosha, Sisra, violated her 7 times. Shenemar, as it says, again, at her very enthusiastic encouragement. If she was forced, there would be no discussion here at all. A woman is karka oilam, she wouldn't be held responsible, and that would be that. But no, the whole point is here, that she was the one egging him on, right? Shenema, ben ragleo koran ofal shochal. Okay. So in other words, we're seeing that actually the response, the prophetic response to this is, Ya'el earned herself a status equal to that of the Emois. Why? Because she did this with pure motives, the right purposes. And again, we'll elaborate on all this. And now the Gemara asks a question which is really going to put this into perspective. How can you say that her Aveira Lishma was so great? She enjoyed it at the end of the day. She enjoyed it. Omer Rabbi Yochanan says, no, she did not. Kol toivosan shel rishayim eina elo ra'a etel tzadikim. What the Rishayim enjoy is simply bad for the tzaddik. For our purposes, that's all we need. Meaning, in other words, what the Gemara is saying, it's not true. Ya'el did not enjoy what was going on at all.
Wait, what was the Hava mean again that she enjoyed it?
The physical action is pleasurable.
But Sisra.
What's that?
Sisra, but it's the
Rosh Hador? Like what would be the actual
Rosh Hador? But if the Rosh Hador makes a good pizza, you'll enjoy the pizza, right? So lamaisa, the physical action, unless a woman is actually forced, the physical action is enjoyable.
What's the portion if it's enjoyable to have pure motives in it?
Oh, okay. So this is really where we're going now. Tysus already asks. Basically, everybody asks. What's the Gemara's question? Mara said that she did the Avera for the right purposes, which apparently means that she made the right cheshbon. What bearing does it have whether she enjoyed it or not? What was her cheshbon? Her cheshbon was that she needs to save the Jewish people. Right? If that was a proper cheshbon, why should we get into whether she enjoyed it or not? Who cares? So, Tosfos gives the beginning of the answer, and it's really developed by the later authorities. Tosfos says, no, the Pasuk would not praise her if she enjoyed it. The Pasuk makes a big deal out of her. And the Torah wouldn't praise, the Pasuk wouldn't praise her if she enjoyed it. But basically, the later authorities, beginning already with the Toldos Yaakov Yosef and the Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, really brought this out very strong. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, everybody basically says that we have to understand what the concept of an Avera Lishma means. Well, first we'll stop by saying the bottom line. An Avera Lishma loses the status of Avera Lishma if there is any pleasure derived whatsoever. Meaning, if a person does an Avera for the right reasons and enjoys it, it remains a pure Avera. That's all. There's no such thing as enjoying an Avera for the right reason.
So let's say with Shimshon, like he's taken a task for enjoying what he was supposed to do, but it was still a mitzvah, wasn't it? Meaning,
we'll get to Shimshon. That's a sugya in itself. I don't want to get into that now. The truth is that Shimshon really was blamed for the way he expressed himself more than anything else. But we'll leave that for now.
Wasn't it more because of his eyes?
That was the way he expressed it. Kihi yosho be'enai. But we'll see when we get there. That's a complex sugya also. We'll get there. But one complex thing at a time. So, basically what we're saying here is as follows. Yes, there's a concept of Avera Lishma. There's a concept of Avera Lishma. But as soon as you enjoy... Avera Lishma does not just mean that you made the right cheshbon. As soon as you enjoy the Avera, it loses all its legitimacy. An Avera can only have legitimacy as an Avera Lishma if there's absolutely no pleasure, if it's just overcoming. Now what's the idea here? Let's explain. What is the science behind an Avera Lishma? What does this mean? As far as we know, Torah is absolute. There are mitzvahs, and there are Averas. It's black and white. What's an Avera Lishma? So the answer is as follows. This is how the Ikarim lays it down, and this is really what comes out of all these authorities who discuss it. There are mitzvahs that are absolute mitzvahs. Sukkah, Matzah, etc., Shabbos. These mitzvahs are mitzvahs no matter how you approach them. Right? As long as you intend to fulfill the mitzvah, you enjoy it, you don't enjoy it, you do it with the krechts, you do it happily. You did the mitzvah and you're going to get schar. There might be different levels of schar, as we'll get to, depending on how you did the mitzvah. But a mitzvah is a mitzvah, period. Then, there are all kinds of parva actions. And then there are averas. So now, there are two ways that something can be a mitzvah. Either it can be a mitzvah because it's a mitzvah. It's one of those 613 things. Sorry, 248 things that the Torah lists of positive mitzvahs. Or it can be a mitzvah because of the proper feelings that you put into it. Meaning, there are feelings, there are sentiments, there are emotions that are mitzvahs too. Caring for Klal Yisrael is a mitzvah. Loving Hashem is a mitzvah. Sometimes you might channel these things into some other action that in and of itself is not a mitzvah. Therefore, for example, eating. Is eating a mitzvah? If a person is eating because he really wants to experience Hashem's love that's in the food, that eating is a very big mitzvah. If a person is eating just because there's food so I'm going to eat, the eating is not a mitzvah. Meaning there are things that, depending on what you put into the action, will determine it as a mitzvah or not. So, when it comes to something like eating, there could be a mixture. I have some mitzvah intent, some stomach intent. So then, it'll be part mitzvah, part plain. Right? If it's 35% mitzvah intent, it'll be 35% mitzvah. When it comes to an Avera, there's no room for any mixture of It has to be all mitzvah in order for the avera to turn into a mitzvah. Meaning, an avera can turn into a mitzvah if a person does an avera with that full intent of just love of Hashem, love of Klal Yisrael, whatever it is. If it's thought out, there's got to be a cheshbon also, obviously, right? You can't just decide, I'm going to express my love of Hashem by bowing down to an idol, right? But if there's a reason, and a person invests in that avera, what is the reason? The reason, let's say, here is care for Klal Yisrael. A person invests in that avera just pure care for Klal Yisrael with nothing else, the feeling behind the avera turns the avera into a mitzvah, but only if it's pure. Once there's any personal pleasure mixed in, that can't be a mitzvah.
When does anyone, good nefesh, when does that ever allow to feel their rise? This is like the worst form of feel their rise.
Oh, okay. So now we move on to the next stage of our discussion. At the end of the day, what was Yael's basis? What was Yael's basis? Is there a halachic rule that we can derive from here? Or was this simply an issue of one-time discretion? So some understand it to be, yes, there is a halachic rule here. Like Reb Nosson just pointed out, Gilui Arayos is one of the things that you have to be killed rather than transgress. Even Pikuach Nefesh does not override Gilui Arayos. Yet, one thing does. Saving all of the Jewish people. In fact, we have another example of this. There you go. Esther was the same thing. What basis did she have to go do what she did? Same thing. She saved all of the Jewish people. That does sanction even the Shalish Chamulas.
If I can go to linear, let's say Hitler Yamak Shemal, if there was a woman who could have stopped what he was doing, it may have been mutter.
Right. Right.
So that's only if she doesn't take any pleasure.
But that's only if she doesn't take any pleasure. That's
you
what comes out of the Gemara.
Does she take any pleasure to authority also for the sake of the Jewish nation?
So that comes out a little bit sticky. I don't know. I wondered, according to the equation about how the Mepharshim set it up,
but I mean,
you kind of get stuck there. I'm not sure.
But a physical pleasure, meaning if she goes in with the right intents and everything, the right kavana, if she has physical pleasure, that's something that she's beyond her control.
But then she shouldn't allow herself. Okay, so you know what? I would assume, you know what, you're right. I would assume that according to this understanding, and again, this is one understanding, we'll get to the other understanding soon. According to this understanding, no. There's actually a halachic guideline that's being expressed here. When we say Aver Lishma, it's kind of a misnomer. What we really mean is, this is a very unique case where it's actually permitted to do Gilui Arayos. That's the halacha. According to this understanding, I would assume that that's right. The fact that she enjoyed might have taken away some of her credit, but Lamaisa, that's the halacha. To save the Jewish people, you can go ahead and perform Gilui Arayos. And some do understand it that way. Some do understand that way, that this is actually a halachic rule. Should it be relevant? You can save the Jewish people through Gilui Arayos. But others clearly do not understand this way. That this was not based on any clear halachic principle that she derived. Rather, it was simply her call. Now, if we want to understand quite to what extent that is, the Tzadik HaKohen says that she, as far as she was concerned, she forfeited her Olam Haba. As far as she was concerned, she was doing an Avera. Avera Lishma means literally, this was not a mitzvah, it was an Avera. And yet she felt she had to do it because of her overwhelming love for the Jewish people and for Hashem, who's the patron of the Jewish people. She actually was ready to forfeit her Olam Haba. That's what Reb Tzadik HaKohen says.
Is that like a kanai?
What's that?
Is it like Pinchas, a kanai?
No, Pinchas did the right thing. Here, it's kind of paradoxical. Just a second. Kind of paradoxical. She did the wrong thing in order to save the Jewish people. I want to address this, and this is very complex.
Sounds like one of the answers to the Jewish losers. Sounds like a reform movement.
Right. Right. How do we understand this? So the truth is, we find also examples of this. Meaning, in other words, what we're saying is, a similar thing is by Aaron HaKohen, which also very puzzling. It says that Aaron HaKohen, when he cooperated with Diego, what was the idea?
There are things that justify.
So that's.
Was it a heter?
So according to the first understanding, it was a real heter that could be put down in halacha. To save the Jewish people, you can do this. Right. It's just an issue of how much credit you'll get. But according to this understanding, the way Reb Tzadik says it is that no, in her mind, she was doing an avera. She did not have a heter to do it, and she did it anyways because of what she felt she needed to achieve, or she decided to achieve, and she didn't know if she was making the right call or not. Meaning, she did not know that what she was doing was a mitzvah. In her mind, it was an avera that she was doing anyways because of her dedication to Hashem and His people.
It wasn't Lashem Shemayim, it was
Lashem
the Jewish people. But
what's Lashem the Jewish people? Ultimately, that's not humaneness. It's because of your sensitivity to the fact that Hashem is in love with them.
But that's like saying that we have to save the Jewish people, we have to get rid of the burden of keeping your mezuzah on the outside of the door.
Okay, that's what I'm getting at. Let's talk about the example of Aaron HaKohen also. What were you told about Aaron HaKohen? Aaron HaKohen cooperated with the eagle in order to take all the blame on himself, knowing that he'll lose the Olam Haba, but he was willing to do it in order to save the Jewish people. What is that supposed to mean? Meaning, the Miman of Shafir, this doesn't add up. If he understood, and if Yael understood, that this is what Hashem wants, then they understood that they're not forfeiting their Olam Haba. If they understood that they're forfeiting their Olam Haba to do it, that means that Hashem does not want it. So where's the piety in doing it? I'm really bringing this up not because I have a clear answer to this, but just to show how perplexing of a concept this is. The only thing I could think,
meaning maybe the answer is that usually when a person has such a suffix, the Sheval Taisa Odi. But over here,
that's how I understand it. Meaning as follows: certainly, if she would know clearly Hashem does not want her to do this, she wouldn't do it. We would not transgress the word of Hashem to save the Jewish people. Certainly not. If Hashem doesn't want it done, doesn't want it done. The Jewish people is Hashem's problem. He'll figure out how to save them. The pshat here, l'chayra, is, and this is the only way I can conceive that this can be worked out properly, go between the drops here, is that she wasn't sure. She was torn. Does Hashem want me to do this or not? If He wants me to do it, I have to go ahead with it. If He doesn't want me to do it, I realize that I'm getting myself into the deepest, lowest state of what a woman can be in, the deepest place in Gehenna. I'm going to lose my husband, which we'll discuss soon, etc. But no. But any man whose wife betrays him becomes asur to her. So she was torn, and yet she felt that she should go ahead with it in case this is the right thing to do, realizing that she might be wrong, and then she'll be forfeiting her Sheol Olam Haba, her whole future, everything. She'll be finished with her life. She'll be an outcast of society. She'll be disgraced. Nobody will give her an ounce of credit because she did the wrong thing. And yet she did it because she felt that perhaps it's the right thing. Or she felt that it was the right thing, but realized that she might be wrong. And she had the guts, she had the backbone to take the call, and to make the call for herself. And Lamaisa, she did not know, after doing it, where do I stand today? Am I now finished with the Jewish people? Am I cut off for eternity? Am I in Gehenna? And then Devaira came along and said, Tevairach mi nashim Yael. Now, not only Tevairach mi nashim Yael, but the truth is, there is so much what we put into this action. Meaning, here we see the absolute selflessness, how she completely negated herself to do what she did, right? Not knowing whether, you know, can you imagine the psychological terror, the torture? I mean, it's one thing if you know you're doing something heroic. Even if you die, you'll die as a martyr. Can you imagine? It's another thing to know, I'm risking my life, I'm risking my future with my husband, I'm risking my status in the Jewish people. I might go down as one of the dregs of history. Right? And she's going to do it anyways. Because at the end of the day, she feels that this is the right thing to do. But she knows that it's likely that it's not so. And she did it with the willingness that she would lose her Olam Haba if it's not. You know what Chazal say Lamaisa came out of this cohabitation? Rabbi Akiva. said that Sisra, what actually happened was there was much deeper things. I don't know if Yael herself was aware of what was going on. I don't know. The Ben Ish Chaim Mamish dissects it Kabbalistically. What each of the seven cohabitations achieved on the Kabbalistic level.
Well, seven?
He was with her seven times.
Seven
times.
So this was spread over time?
Over a few hours. However long it was. Part of the point was to keep him in her tent. So this was seven times. And she egged it on. Right? So Lamaisa, the way the Sfarim put it is that yes, as far as she was concerned, he was contaminating her, cutting her off from the Jewish people, landing her in Gehenim. What was actually going on was, with her selflessness, with that absolute dedication, with that complete mesius nefesh in honor of Hashem and the Jewish people, she was reaching in past all of his tumah and connecting to that spark of Kedusha that was buried way down deep inside of him. Because the truth is, this doesn't mean that we're giving Sisra any credit. Every wicked person in history had the same spark of Kedusha. There's a rule, a spiritual law of nature, that Tumah can only feed off Kedusha. Which is that actually Sisra had something inside him which was feeding so much Kedusha that if it could be wrenched out, extracted from that Tumah, it could turn into something extremely great. And actually, what was she actually doing? She was squeezing more out of him, squeezing more out of him each time, right? Until she reached the point where she, with her mesirus nefesh, she reached past all that tumah and managed to access that kedusha, pulled it out from him into herself, and that produced the greatest figure in Torah Shebaal Peh, Rabbi Akiva.
She became pregnant from that?
So here there are two understandings as to exactly what happened here. Either yes, she became pregnant and ultimately Rabbi Akiva descended from this, or some presented on the more Kabbalistic level that every cohabitation causes conception on the spiritual level. A neshama is created from every cohabitation, even more than that. What's that? Okay, we'll have to see. 1 minute. But every, what's that?
Yes, you're saying
every cohabitation, you know, this gets problematic. You know what? One minute. We'll see. We'll see. Eved Ababas Yisrael. If a guy is with a Jewish woman, it's a shayla if there's mamzerus or not. It's a machoikis. Rabbi Akiva holds that yes. We're getting into sensitive territory. Let's see. Let's wait. Okay? Well, whatever it is, every cohabitation creates a neshama. Not just every cohabitation. Every time a person gives off seed, it creates a neshama, even if it's not in cohabitation. What level of that neshama will be will depend on what was going on at the time. And therefore, yeah, that's where the famous concept comes from. When a person is busy wasting seed, it creates all kinds of problematic creatures that he has to contend with afterwards. But some understand it just on this level, that from this cohabitation, the neshama of Rabbi Akiva was directly created. It wasn't the descendant of later generations. This is what produced the neshama of Rabbi Akiva. And Reb Chaim Friedlander says that this is mamish, the direct result of what was going on here. It required an action like this to produce Rabbi Akiva. What was Rabbi Akiva? As we just said before, he was the champion of Torah Shebaal Peh. Where Rabbeinu Gershom puts it in Bava Basra is, Kimlam, now don't ask me questions on this because I can't answer them, but the lashon of Rabbeinu Gershom Bava Basra is, Kimlam deloy have gavra rabba kavasei. We know that there was never as great a person as Rabbi Akiva. I know. I don't know the answer. But that's the lashon of Rabbeinu Gershom. Okay? Now, what is Torah Shebaal Peh? Torah Shebaal Peh is the transmittal of Torah through the human medium, right? The person serving as the transmitter of Torah Shebaal Peh. In order for that to be done in the greatest way possible, what that requires is for a person to completely negate any personal feelings, tendencies, etc., and just work to completely align himself with the spirit of the Torah, with the attitudes of the Torah, to just be a transparent conveyor of Torah. And if we're saying that Rabbi Akiva was the greatest transmitter of Torah Shebaal Peh, that means that this is what Rabbi Akiva was. He completely negated any ego, anything personal about himself. He was just a direct conduit. Everything about him just reflected Torah. Torah simply shone through him to the world.
That was a natural thing. That was with work. I mean,
That's true. But he was destined to do that from the beginning of time. However that works. We know that Moshe Rabbeinu already had a vision of Rabbi Akiva doing that. Right? So Reb Chaim Friedlander says something beautiful. He says, that davka came from this cohabitation, which reflected the greatest level of self-negation perhaps ever that was going on at the time of cohabitation. Where Yael came and gave up not only that she completely didn't enjoy it, that she felt disgusted by the whole thing and overcame that, but the fact that she was giving up on her life as a wife, and that she was giving up on all of her eternity in her mind, right? She was giving up all of her Olam Haba, all of her eternity. That's the epitome of self-negation. This was the cohabitation that could produce a Rabbi Akiva. That's how Reb Chaim Friedlander puts it. This is the koyach of an avera lishma. Meaning we're seeing what. Yes, it was an avera. Again, according to this understanding, she did not think she had halachic sanction to do it. But what was being put into it, right? That's what gave it all its weight. It was an avera that was simply packed with such purity that we see that it was put on the greatest of levels. But again, we should come away with this realizing that the concept of Aveir Lishma is completely beyond us. That's what's basically stressed by these Mepharshim, stress this idea.
We're going to get to the point though about how, like, the fact is that, like, I have no doubt that the early people in Germany in the 1840s, they weren't out to harm the Jewish people. They were there to try to make it better. In the same way that, meaning if she thought she was doing an Avera,
No. The point is that she was not. It's not that she thought she was doing an avera. It's like we explained before. It's very subtle. She felt that this is probably the right thing for her to do. She realized, though, that she's not necessarily right. That was the idea. And whereas a person might decide to play it safe and sit back and say, I'm not going to act, she felt, there's two sfeikas here. There's a suffix, is this the right thing for me to do or not? But in her mind, it was a different suffix. Is it a suffix that this is what Hashem kiveyachol requires right now? And if He requires it kiveyachol, and the Jewish people require it, and it's the right thing to do, then it's crucial that I do it. So, if we'll put it this way, if we'll allow ourselves to use these words, this might be something that Hashem desperately wants, and it might be something that's going to get me to Gehenna. But since it might be something that Hashem desperately wants, I'm going to do it, even though it might get me to Gehenna.
But we're talking about something which you'd rather...
You know, maybe we'll save more dialogue for afterwards. I don't want to spend too much time. It's complex. It needs to settle in the mind. But that's really what happened here. That's why Reb Tzadik stresses that this was an act that could only come from intense Avas Hashem. It couldn't come from Yira. Yira would dictate, I'm not touching this. But she was there. Yeah, she was already in the situation. And it was a situation where either Kiviyochel Hashem desperately wants her to do it, or she lands in Gehenim and she chose to do it. Sorry? What's that? I'll ask you to listen to the recording from the beginning. But that's basically what we worked through now. But okay. You're right. I mean, that's the big problem here. Okay. Now, we do have to move on to one other tough question. And that is Salamaisa. In pure halachic terms, how was this act classed? And this has a very important implication, because it could be that at the end of the day, if, yes, it was deemed that under the circumstances she did the right thing, but halachically it was classed as nus, she remains prohibited to her husband. That would be kind of anticlimactic to come away from this story knowing that the end of the story was that Yael's husband had to divorce her. And according to many pretty significant authorities, that was the case. We have to realize that yes, the sacrifice was not just theoretical. It was very real. she was prohibited to him afterwards. Again, I'm going with this first day. We'll analyze both shittas. But basically, the Maharik and the Beis Shmuel say with regard to Esther that that was the case. Esther became prohibited to Mordechai after she went to Achashverosh willingly the first time. And the Meshech Chochma says that the same was true for Yael. She became prohibited to her husband. And in fact, this is a tragic part of the story, but again, we're seeing that Yael was actually a martyr. It wasn't just that she did a great thing and after that, it was life happily ever after. She was a martyr in this sense. In fact, the Meshech Chochma says that when it says back at the beginning, remember the way it was termed back at the beginning of the story? When the Devorah prophesied what was going to happen, what was her terminology? She said, "Ki biyad isha yimkar Hashem Sisra." Hashem will sell Sisra into the hand of a woman. That was how Devorah put it. So the Meshech Chochma says that means quite literally. She got this chus, but she paid a heavy price for it. She purchased this chus. She paid a heavy price for it. She paid for it with her marriage. Because she became prohibited to her husband after that. That's shita number one. But we'll relieve the oilam by saying that there's a large camp of authorities on the other side of the fence who say that no, she certainly did not become prohibited. This includes the Chasam Sofer, the Shlomo Eger, Peiros Yaakov, the Kli Yaka. They all say that no, she was permitted, and they actually infer it from the way the Vayra put it. Tevorach binashim Ya'el eishes chever hakeni. May Ya'el be blessed by women. Ya'el, the wife of chever hakeni. Again, like we said before, Ya'el herself was in suspense to see what is the ruling going to be on her action. Not only was her act vindicated, but the Vayra came along with another piece of news. Ya'el, you still till today remain the wife of Chever HaKeni. You did not become prohibited to him. Meaning once it was ruled upon in Shamayim that she had done the right thing, she was not considered to have betrayed her husband, and therefore she was permitted to remain with him. Right. So that, right.
They can put the two legacies together.
What's that?
That's not necessarily the case. It could be that she was just mother to her husband because she was no worse than Amos. Well, also, for example, Israel of Kahuna.
I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't know. Okay. Now we'll move on. Maim Sha'al Chalav Nasana. We just finished the psukim that describe what happened with her. When he asked for water, she gave him milk. Dvaira is continuing just to lay out the story. B'sefel Adirim Hikriva Chema. She served him butter, meaning she served him fatty milk in a bowl of very, very great prestige, meaning she had a very, very chashava bowl that was really just there for display. They never took it down. But she used this to serve Sisera in order to, again, that whole impression of that she just couldn't get over the unbelievable privilege she has at hosting him. Yodola Yosef Tishlachna. She sent her hand to the spike. V'imino la'almus amelim. She used her right hand to smash the weary. The Homa Sisra. She smashed Sisra. Mochakor Yishoi. She erased his head. O mochatzo v'chol farakosoi. And she simply broke through and passed through his temple. Now here also, the Mefarshim note, Tishlachna. Yodolayotet Tishlachna. She sent her hand to the spike. But actually, the way it's worded in Lashon Kodesh is, Tishlachna is plural. They sent her hand to the spike. That's how it translates literally. Kailas Yaakov notes this, and he says that here also, Devorah is telling Ya'el. Again, Ya'el came away from this experience. She did what she did. And she didn't know how to view herself now, right? And she was quaking to hear, what, where do I stand now? What's with me? So in addition to everything she was just told, right? Tevorach minashim ba'oyel. She's blessed with Sarif Koch and Leah. And she's Eishes Chever HaKeni. Now she says, you think that it was just you picking up that spike? It was the two of you together. It was Ya'el together with the Shechina. That's the plural here. Ben Raguel Koran Ofal Shochav. And this is the pasuk from where Chazal derives this seven times. Between her legs, he collapsed, he fell, he lied. Bein ragleo, kora nofal. Between her legs, he collapsed and he fell. Ba'ashel kora, shom nofal. Where he collapsed, there he fell, shadud. Completely wasted. Very wordy pasuk. That's basically what that pasuk is saying. What? Shadud means wasted. He felt spent. But again, there are seven expressions here of his falling, collapsing, which are all denoting the seven times that he was with her. So again, what the pasuk just alludes to, Chazal spell out for us, and we see what actually came out of that action. Okay? Only another few psukim in the Shira. We'll see Bezos Hashem next week. We need it.